You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Well, it's been quite an exciting month here in the UK. We had the National Astronomy Meeting and the European Week of Astronomy and Space Science. They hosted their joint meeting at the start of April up in Liverpool. So, Edward, you weren't able to go.
I wasn't, no. And I was organising a session as well, so I was rather disappointed by that.
But I managed to get along to some of it, and it was good fun. Lots of news stories from the European astronomy community as well. Now, that happened just after the announcement, a few days after the announcement from NASA that the James Webb, or NASA and ESA, that the James Webb Space Telescope was going to be delayed. This is, well, I guess the next big thing in astronomy. It's a big mission.
It's a huge mission. Lots of people call it the descendant of Hubble. It's not really, because Hubble is a visible light telescope, or an optical telescope, as we tend to call them, still in space. JWST is an infrared telescope, so it'll look at totally different things to Hubble. For those of you with good memories, you may remember the Herschel Space Observatory, or Herschel Space Telescope, which was launched back in 2009. That was also infrared, but looking at very different type of infrared light to James Webb Space Telescope. Unfortunately, it's been plagued with delays for its entire history, I think.
I mean, lots of missions of this size often are. Hubble had its own fair share of delays.
And disasters.
And disasters, yeah. And what they don't want with Hubble, some people may remember back in 1990 when Hubble was launched, it was then discovered to have dodgy optics. So they had to launch another mission a couple of years later to go and fix that, to the cost of some huge amount of money, billions of dollars, no doubt. James Webb is going to a place where it won't be able to be serviced by astronauts. So it has to work first time, and it's very technologically challenging to get it to open and unfurl and everything.
Yeah, and the reason for that is because you don't want it anywhere near the Earth, because the Earth is quite bright in infrared light. It glows because it has temperature, just like everything with temperature glows with some sort of light, and the Earth just happens to be in a nice bit of the infrared. So we want to be far away from the Earth, and so it's in orbit, not around the Earth, but around the Sun, but keeping in step with the Earth, very much like Herschel and Planck do.
So the delay is from what was going to be early next year till 2020, so about a year or so's delay. Now, you might think that, oh, that's fine, they've got to fix a few things, they've got to check a few things at work. They had some problems with the sun shield, which shields it from the sun's glare. I think they found some tiny tears in that they need to figure out how they got there, and that's certainly something they don't want to happen in real life when the thing launches. But of course there is a huge cost, because all those people working on the mission have got to be employed for an extra year. You can't just, they're not going to go and find another job for a year and then come back in a year's time. So actually a lot of it is the staff cost of all those people working on the mission.
Yeah, very, very expensive. With missions with space missions, they are incredibly expensive compared to ground-based missions, and you have all sorts of launch windows then that you have to. So there's obviously, there was a launch window that it had reserved, and it's now missed that one. There may even be financial penalties to not taking that up, but then you have to wait for an appropriate one again. They all cost some amount of money.
Yeah. Now, it's also close to hitting its cost cap that the United States Congress have given them to not go above. So we'll see what happens if it gets much closer to that. So it's not in no means cancelled. It is going to go ahead, but just slightly later than planned. It's also worth saying that it's better to delay it than have it launch and break when it's up there.
Yeah, very definitely, yeah. Seeing as it can't be serviced at all.
So this costs them a little bit, whereas if it launches and then breaks, that's, I don't know, over $10 billion completely down the drain, effectively.
Yeah.
Which would be a real shame. So that was kind of the precursor to the European Week of Astronomy and Space Science. So there are a few stories that came out of this as well. One was the ages of stars in the Milky Way. Now, when we look at stars in the sky, we can see their brightness and their colour. It's hard to tell a lot more about them from simple observations, and in particular, their ages are very hard to tell without detailed models of stars. So how do you age a star?
Yeah, well, you really have to understand what sort of stars are out there, and you look at the colour and you look at the brightness of a star, and then you try to place it on a map that astronomers use of stars called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. You have to find where it exists on this map, and then you infer its age based on what we think we know about stars. And a group of scientists did this, and actually it looks like there are stars in the Milky Way in the bulge, which the very center, which look like they're very, very old. They're considerably older than we thought, like something like 11 billion years old.
I think the youngest ones they found are about 7 billion years old as well. So they are a very old population of stars.
And when we talk about populations of stars, as astronomers, we think that there are three significant populations of stars which have different makeups compared to our sun. Our sun has it has mostly hydrogen in it, but it has other elements in it as well, and it has heavier elements than that, whereas these stars will have had much, much less of those little seed elements like nitrogen and boron and silicon and things like that.
So learning more about the evolution of the stars in the center of the Milky Way, and maybe how the Milky Way is built up, that will fall out of this, how the galaxy as a whole has evolved over billions of years. Another story that caught our eye was hotspots on neutron stars. So this was all about neutron stars, the dead hulks of massive stars that have left this this remnant that's about the mass of the sun or thereabouts and only 10, 20 kilometres across.
Yeah, incredibly dense. If you imagine, there's the typical example of a teaspoon of this stuff will weigh as much as a mountain. It's very, very dense. And the original star would have been composed of, you know, lots of different elements because it had been churning away, turning hydrogen into heavier things. But then when it dies, the great crash towards the center converts all of those other elements into neutrons. Mm. And that's why you just get left with neutrons at the end.
Now, these do have a strong magnetic field, thought to be from bits of them churning in different rates inside, all that material inside, churning around, generating magnetic fields, and they can get wrapped around each other. And there's been a study that's shown that some neutron stars can have incredibly hot spots from these sort of knots in the magnetic field, which get tangled up and focus a lot of heat on one particular part of the star's surface and make a very, very hot part of the star, which can survive for a very, very long time.
It's really, really interesting, actually, the universality of the laws of physics, because we see this type of thing on the sun.
Yeah.
And to have such a different type of star as a neutron star, but still has, you know, some sort of fluid that is moving on in its interior and on its surface, in the same way that the fluid on the surface of the sun is moving, producing these magnetic fields that are getting tangled up and having hotspots.
So lots we've yet to learn about neutron stars as well. There's also a lot of interdisciplinary work. So sometimes astronomers take techniques from other fields, and sometimes other fields take techniques from astronomy. So an output here into ecology, where looking for endangered species. So this was a talk I went to, I think. So there's a group of ecologists looking to monitor the populations of various wildlife, various species in different parts of the world. And one of the things they're trying to do is maybe use infrared cameras, thermal cameras, to track where these animals are. But the problem is, if you've ever seen a thermal camera image, you've got a kind of a splodgy background normally of the ground, maybe with some trees or grass or bushes on it. And then you maybe get some little spots that are the bright body temperature of the animals on the surface, whatever animals those might be. Now, they might be different temperatures, depending on what type of animal they are. A rabbit might be a different temperature to a hippo, for example. And a rabbit is obviously smaller than a hippo as well. But actually picking them out is really tricky. And a lot of the techniques used in astronomy image analysis are useful for this kind of thing as well, because that's what astronomers are doing, looking at blobs on a messy background.
Yeah, and particularly if you imagine the analogy even more, where you've got actually very faint sources. If you're looking from some height with a drone, then the contrast between your hippo and the ground after a warm day might not be too different. And this is something that we do all the time in astronomy. You've got something low signal to noise, where your signal is, you have to just make a judgment on whether your signal is significant or not, whether there is a real thing or not. And that's where your signal-to-noise ratio comes in. So you look at how many individual photons above your noise threshold you've got, whether you've got a galaxy or, in this case, whether you've got a hippo.
One of the things that's often done in these situations is something called machine learning, which is basically giving a computer a set of rules to use to have a good stab at what they're looking at and to try and establish what they're looking at. So in this case, rather than people going saying, you know, calculating how warm a rabbit might be and what it might look like, actually they're just going to a zoo and looking at a zoo, which is a good place to start, and look at animals in all sorts of situations.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with machine learning is you have to be really careful, because if you with machine learning, you have to give it a training set where you know the outcome. And if you put junk into it, you will then always find junk.
Yeah, junk in, junk out. Yeah. Which is always a problem with these things. One of the big things that's a hot topic at the moment, of course, is exoplanets. Planets going around other stars. And one of the things that is of concern there is what that star might do to the planets going around it. There's a big concern that if you get a star that's particularly active, that chucks out a lot of X-rays, they might actually damage or cause problems for any life on the surface. They could sterilize the planet, for example. And there's been some studies that actually this might be happening to some exoplanetary systems.
Yeah, that's it's a big problem, because stars aren't always these nice quiescent things. We tend to think of our sun as being a perfectly normal star, but actually it has quite violent storms on occasion. Fortunately, it doesn't have massive amount of X-rays, which we are totally irradiating the Earth regularly. But we really need to study this, because people want to know about the potential habitability of planets, with the ultimate goal of discovering alien life.
One key example announced a couple of years ago now was something called Proxima B, a planet going around Proxima Centauri, the nearest star to us. And while the campaign was going on to study this star to see if they could find a planet going around it, which they eventually did, and they found LCO, which you were for.
Yeah, that's right. Well. Yeah, that's in fact one of the things that, because normally you look for a star which is not varying at all. It's a perfectly stable star if you're looking for planets. And this is what Kepler did a lot of. The Kepler spacecraft was particularly looking at stars that were a certain type of star and were stable. Well, Proxima B isn't particularly stable. It has what's called astroseismology, and it can have flares. And flares were discovered during the campaign looking for this planet around Proxima Centauri. So that was one of the things that we were doing as an observatory, was getting a baseline signal, seeing, you know, what the variability was there any regularity in that, so that when we saw the tiny blip of an exoplanet, that we knew it was the tiny blip of an exoplanet and not a tiny blip of the star quaking or something.
But back in March 2016, there was the largest flare that had been witnessed from this star erupted. So it gave astronomers back then a bit of a surprise, those involved in the campaign. But that's the kind of thing that is of concern to any potential life on these planets.
Yes, that's right.
Luckily, as you say, our sun doesn't do that very often. Now, exoplanets are in the news a lot. We've had a launch of a new mission, the TESS satellite, the NASA's TESS satellite, which is kind of a follow-up to Kepler, the very famous satellite that's been studying and finding thousands of planets going around other stars. What these missions can tell us, they can tell us the size of the planet, other methods can tell us the mass of the planet, and so by combining those we can get the density of the planet and maybe have a guess at what they're made of, whether they're made of rock or iron or water or gas, and get an idea for that. But it really doesn't tell us what the planets are like. And so to do that, we want to do something called spectroscopy. That's splitting the light into its wavelengths and looking at the atmosphere in more detail. And there is a plan to do this, again, from up in space, a European Space Agency mission called Ariel, which was selected earlier this month and is due to be launched in about a decade's time. And here in Cardiff, my colleague Dr. Subi Sarkar is involved in that mission. And I spoke to Subi about exoplanet research.
Kepler really revolutionised the exoplanet field. So this was a space-based telescope that basically looked at the patch of sky for about 4 years, and something like 500,000 stars in that patch of sky. And it looked for little dips in the starlight as planets crossed over the stars. And so this is the famous transit technique, which your listeners may have heard of. Mm. And
it's kind of like an eclipse, but the planet's much, much smaller than the star from our point of view. So when we see an eclipse, the moon blocks out the whole star. This is a planet blocking out a tiny fraction of the star's light.
Yeah. So if you measure the light from the star very, very carefully, you can trace out the dip. And from that information, you can actually work out the size of the planet, because there's a relationship between how deep the dip is and how large the planet is relative to the star. And so we can actually get, not only discover planets using the transit method, but we can actually work out the size of the planets that we're discovering. So when Kepler looked at all these stars, he didn't know quite what he was going to find, but it basically found thousands of new planets and was able to work out the sizes of all these new planets. And what Kepler really showed us for the first time is that small planets, so planets about the size of the Earth or slightly bigger, are actually the most common type of planets. And that's very exciting because, of course, we live on a rocky planet. Mm. And one of the things in the exoplanet field, one of the holy grails, is really the search for Earth-like planets and maybe even the search for life. And so to find that Earth-sized planets or super-Earth-sized planets are actually very, very common was a really important discovery.
And so one of the things that TESS, NASA's mission, is going to do is going to find even more planets. So in what way is it different to Kepler? How is it going to be different from what Kepler's been doing? It's not just a straight continuation.
No, so Kepler was very much a kind of, if you like, a pathfinder. It's a revolution in its own right. But the way it worked is, as I said, it looked at one patch of sky in Cygnus and Lyra, I think it was. And some of the stars that it looked at were actually quite far away. So you had no control over necessarily whether the stars were close or bright. You just looked at this patch of sky. So what TESS will be... And the problem with that is that although we got all these nice measurements, we weren't able to follow up those measurements with other instruments from the ground, let's say, or other space-based instruments.
Where you want a bright star to be able to see clearly, for example.
Yeah. So, for example, one of the things we'd like to do, if you discover a planet with a transit technique, is to follow it up with another technique, such as the wobble method, the radial velocity method. Because the transit method can give you the radius of the planet, or the size, if you like, the diameter, and then the wobble method can give us the mass of the planet. Now, if you take mass over volume, you get the density of the planet. So, and actually, if you remember your maths, you can work out the volume of the sphere from its radius. And so by these two techniques, we can actually get a bulk density for the planet, and that can tell you a lot about the planet. Maybe if it's a very dense planet, it might indicate it's made of a rock or metal. If it's a very low density planet, it might be gaseous. There are intermediate densities, and that's where spectroscopy comes in to kind of break those degeneracies. But we like to do follow up, and one of the issues with Kepler was it's difficult to do follow up on many of its planets. So what TESS will be doing is a similar technique to Kepler, and it's a transit method, but TESS will be looking all over the sky. So it'll be looking at a patch of sky for a few weeks, and then moving on and looking at another patch, and gradually tiling out the entire sky over 2 years. And the stars it will be focusing on will be brighter stars closer to us, and so the planets that it discovers will be much more amenable to follow-up techniques such as the radial velocity from the ground, or indeed other space-based telescopes like the Hubble or James Webb Space Telescope or Ariel in the future.
So one of the things that's going to happen as well over the coming years is there'll be more missions to go and look at exoplanets as well. So as well as TESS, which has just launched, as well as Kepler, which is kind of nearing the end of its mission, I guess, there's CHEOPS coming up, due for launch later this year. CHEOPS is a European Space Agency mission, so Europe have been heavily involved in this, both through the European Southern Observatory here on the ground, and also through space-based missions, Corot being a satellite that they've had before, and now CHEOPS, due to be launched later this year. The CHEOPS is also looking at transits, but it's got a special focus on ones that we already know about. What's CHEOPS doing that's different?
Yeah, so CHEOPS, again, is using the transit method, so just like TESS and Kepler. But what CHEOPS is a little different is that it won't be discovering new planets. So TESS and Kepler basically look at patches of sky trying to detect new blips in the starlight, discovering new planets. What CHEOPS will be doing is focusing on planets that have already been discovered from the ground, perhaps, with radial velocity methods. And so these are planets that we know about, and we may have their masses as well from this technique. But as I said before, what we'd like to do is to get the mass and the radius of a planet, so I guess it's the density. And CHEOPS will be the first space-based telescope to do this kind of high-precision transit observation of planets that have already been discovered. So its goal is going to be different. Although the technique's the same, the goal will be different from that of TESS. So the plan would be to look at super Earth-sized planets up to Neptune-sized planets and get really precise measurements of their radius.
Now, one of the things with this is because when you're just looking for the star's light to dim slightly, so you're not trying to take a resolved picture of the star, you're not trying to see the planet next to the star or anything. So you don't actually need, although you need a very sensitive telescope, if you're looking at fairly bright stars, you don't need a very big telescope. So a lot of these missions are actually surprisingly small and therefore relatively cheap to launch and fly.
Yeah, I was quite surprised actually when I was checking up on CHEOPS how small the mirror is of CHEOPS. It is a mirror telescope, but it's only 30 centimetres in diameter, I believe. So that's almost the size of some of the telescopes you might be able to buy for your back garden, perhaps. But of course, you know, this telescope's going into space, so it won't have to deal with all the atmosphere. Mm. And it'll probably focus on some of the brighter targets as well. And of course, there's a lot more that goes into a space telescope than the telescopes you have in your back garden. But in terms of size, you're right, yes.
And now, CHEOPS is due for launch, as I said, later this year, and then we'll run for a few years, no doubt, to try and get information on transits that we know about and get more information about those. But transits and radial velocity measurements will tell us about the radius, the size of the planet. It'll tell us about the mass of the planet. It tells us what its average density is, which is useful to be able to distinguish rocky planets from gaseous planets, or maybe these hypothesized sort of liquid ocean planets, water worlds. But that's, you know, we've never actually seen these directly. We'd really want to know what these planets are like. And that, I guess, is where the mission you're heavily involved in, Ariel, comes in. Due for launch in about a decade's time, so planning started. Yeah. What's Ariel going to do for us?
Yeah, so what Ariel will be doing for the first time is what we call a spectroscopic survey from space. So in spectroscopy, what we do, if you remember, if you take a white light beam and you put it through a prism, you basically break it into its different wavelengths.
The same as what happens with a rainbow, effectively.
And from the spectrum, we can tell a lot about what the atmosphere of an exoplanet is actually made of. So we use a technique in Ariel called transit spectroscopy, which is very similar to the transit method itself, in that the planet passes in front of the star. But actually what we do now is to actually, instead of looking at all the light combined together, white light if you like, we split that light into its different wavelengths and then follow the light curves of different wavelengths. So we get different radiuses at different wavelengths, and this can trace out some of the absorbing species in the atmosphere. So we can reconstruct a planet spectrum. So it's a bit complicated how we do it, but the end result is an actual spectrum of the planet atmosphere, and from that we can work out the molecules in the atmosphere, things like the temperature and clouds and various other important features of the atmosphere.
So, for example, if you had a planet that had lots of methane high up in its atmosphere, that would absorb lots of red light, and that would mean when you look at the red part of the spectrum, the methane would look the planet would look slightly bigger than it did at other wavelengths, perhaps, if the methane were high up in the atmosphere, for example. That's the general idea.
Yeah, that's right. So you get an extra amount of absorption, very tiny extra amount of absorption due to molecules in the atmosphere. So if you looked at the light curve, the vast majority of the light curve is due to the planet eclipsing the star. And then a very tiny amount is due to molecules like methane, which will be absorbing an extra amount. So you can imagine that, therefore, the signal is very, very small. In fact, it's, I would say, an order of magnitude smaller or more than the actual transit itself. So it is much more difficult in the sense that the signals are smaller, and of course we have the noise to deal with as well. So aerial will be so this technique has been done before. It's been done in space with the Hubble Space Telescope, which has produced a number of spectra, and also on the ground. But up to now, the spectra that we have been rather incomplete. So either looking at a very narrow part of the spectrum, so we don't get the entire broad spectrum, or the spectra are very, very low resolution. And also observing from the ground, we have problems because we have the atmosphere, which absorbs a lot of infrared radiation. Infrared is the region that we're most interested in, and so it basically blocks out large sections of the spectrum that we'd be interested in. So to get complete coverage, we need to go into space, and we need an instrument that's been designed specifically for exoplanets, which the Hubble really wasn't. It was designed in an era before exoplanet science really took off. It was
launched before the first ever detected exoplanet.
Right. So AERO will be the first dedicated space-based telescope to do exoplanet spectroscopy. And it'll also be doing the largest survey of exoplanets' atmospheres that's ever been done. And so we would hope that the results of this survey, I mean, we don't know exactly what we're going to find, but... It'd be boring if you did. Yeah. But we would hope that, you know, one of the goals really of AERIAL is to try and make sense of the diversity of exoplanets that we know exist now. So we know that there are these wide range of different sizes, different densities of planets, and AERIAL will no doubt show us many different types of atmosphere as well. Can we find some kind of order to this diversity? So that's a really big challenge, of course. If we compare it to other areas of science, in chemistry, for example, you know, the periodic table was constructed, and that kind of gave insight into atomic structure. And in biology, you know, evolution, perhaps we started off with taxonomy, and that kind of led to a unifying theory of evolution.
So people were basically looking for patterns, and as they found the patterns, they actually told them something about the principles, the reasons for those patterns existing. So you're hoping that maybe you'll find something like this with exoplanets.
Well, we hope so. And, you know, actually planet formation, we have lots of theories of planet formation and how planets evolve and so on. But we need data to really constrain those theories. And I think AERIAL, when we look at the whole range of the results that we get from AERIAL, we'll perhaps see some kind of pattern in the data, which will allow us to really understand where do planets come from, how do they evolve. So I think that will be the big contribution of AERIAL, really to try and improve our understanding of how planets evolve, form, and migrate, of course, as well. But also we'll learn a lot more about the planets that we do know. So AERIAL will not be discovering new planets, it will be looking at planets that have already been discovered. And so these planets will be selected by the AERIAL Consortium based on the targets that we think will be the best targets to look at. But there will be a range of different types of planets, different types of stars, and they'll cover a whole range of sizes from super-Earths, hopefully some Earths, all the way up to the Neptunes and hot Jupiters. Lots of different types of stars. So we'll have a very wide range of stars and planets to look at. So this will hopefully tell us a lot more about exoplanet atmospheres and what planets are really made of.
And finally, before we finish, what's your involvement here in Cardiff? Yeah. What are you doing with AERIAL here?
Yeah. So our involvement is in a number of areas, really. The main one that I'm involved in is simulation work. So we've done a lot of the early simulations for AERIAL, looking at how the instrument will perform. So this involves actually simulating the astrophysical scene itself, so the planet, the star, the planet passing in front of the star, and the telescope and the instrument, a virtual version, if you like, of AERIAL on a computer. So it's a lot cheaper than building it.
Yeah.
And we can test out, and of course we have lots of models of the different types of noise that we would expect. And so we can test out if AERIAL will be able to do the science we say it's going to do and whether it can do it in the time it's got to do it, which is about 4 years. So that formed a lot of our involvement during the design development phase. We've also looked at sort of specific scenarios, such as how would particularly complicated types of noise, like star spots or stellar variability or pointing.
So this is often where the star is actually fluctuating in its own right. So as well as a planet making it appear to dim, the star is getting brighter and dimmer itself.
So, you know, one of the things that came out of the Kepler data is that the stars do have these pulsations and oscillations, granulations on the surface, which sometimes is actually data that they want to see, but for exoplanet scientists is actually a type of noise that we would like to not have in the data. So these sorts of things we can simulate, and we can really assess whether Ariel can do the observations that we want it to do. And if there are problems, we can use the simulations to as a test bed to really find solutions. So that work will continue now that we're in the phase B stage of Ariel, and our simulations will basically evolve with the instrument, and at all stages we will ensure that Ariel remains compliant with the requirements of the mission, that we can always complete the science goals of the mission. So that will involve making the simulator a little bit more accurate, and as the instrument hardware gets finalized, as we choose the final detectors and all the we know the characteristics of all the different optical components, so the simulator will add these as well. So we'll always have an up-to-date model. And we'll continue to do some very specific studies. So if new targets come up in the next few years that might be particularly interesting for Ariel, we can use the simulator to really see if Ariel will be able to observe these particular targets. So there are lots of things that we can do with the simulation work. So that's what we're going to primarily be involved in. As part of that, we'll also be involved with developing the pipeline that will actually take the raw images and extract the science from it. And this follows on from the simulation work, because the simulator itself needs to have a pipeline. So that's really interesting, exciting work, because that will take us all the way to actually producing things like the planet spectrum itself.
So it allows you to test if I had an experiment that did something, I can then feed it into my computer code to see how I would go about analysing that data as a sort of a dry run for when you've actually got a real life telescope producing data. And hopefully it all works the same.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So those are two things we'll be involved in. We also will play a role in things like the calibration unit, which is on board the spacecraft. So this is something to make sure the detectors are working, and we know how everything on board is calibrated. And we may have a role in the testing of some of the detectors as well for the mission. So this is Carlos' involvement. We actually have a very quite strong involvement actually in the Ariel mission, so we're all very excited to be involved.
Well, you've got a decade or so's work cut out before the mission is launched, and all the planet involved, and then hopefully several years or many years of analysing the data after that from what hopefully will be an exciting mission. So, Subi Sarkar, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Edward, certainly an exciting decade coming up in exoplanet research. And I guess with ground-based observatories like LCO, you've got your work cut out to follow up all these discoveries.
Yes, so many different surveys now, and particularly not just ones that are dedicated to exoplanets. You've got things like the LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and Pan-STARRS has been operating for a long time. So we definitely, we're very much a follow-up observatory in what's called time domain, where things are changing. And exoplanets are one of our bread and butter research areas, because there are targets, windows of opportunity to view these. And if you happen to miss that, then particularly with a type of exoplanet observation called a microlensing event, then you miss it forever. You never see that thing again. It's not a regular thing like with a transit observation or with a radial velocity, a wobbling exoplanet.
Well, lots to look for in the coming decades. Don't forget, you can find this episode and past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.